great when a plan comes together, isn't it? As the meeting has gone on, actually, from the moment I went into the prayer meeting before this, a great sense of a plan coming together, which isn't necessarily my plan. I believe it's the Lord's plan. Just, you know how it is. Just different strands, different things that are said, tying in with stuff that I knew I was going to be bringing. So a great sense of that this morning, of the Lord's hand on us here. I think that phrase, "it's good when a plan comes together," was probably somewhat in the mind at around about 12:45 a.m. on, I guess, Saturday morning, in the mind of a Mr. Boyle, at the end of the closing ceremony, the opening ceremony even, the close of the opening ceremony. What an amazing spectacle, those of you that managed to see that on TV. I have to confess, I did go to bed just before the end, but I have recorded it, so I will still have the treat of hearing Sir Paul McCartney, which I gather may not be the great climax everyone was looking forward to. Anyway, no, it's great that everyone who took part in that. And if you want to feel closer to the whole Olympic experience, and particularly that opening ceremony in a kind of a 6 degrees of separation way, do before he leaves at 11:45, feel free to come and touch Dave, because his brother Matt was one of those 990 something drummers in the stadium. Absolutely true. So I'm not, I'll tell you when I'm making it up. So it is absolutely true. So, just feel free to touch Dave and you can be part of that Olympic experience. And also to bring you closer to the amazing spectacle that was that opening ceremony, and particularly the heart of everything it conveyed about athletic endeavour. One of the highlights of the opening ceremony, the one that actually provoked me just to put a single word on my Facebook status on that night, which was genius, was the clip that I really do hope we are going to see in just... Here it is. So, yeah. So I'm not quite sure what that does say about athletic endeavour, but I thought it was brilliant. I kind of wanted to talk about giving. I was thinking about what title to give it. I thought giving probably is as good a title as any, although it might not be taking you down the route that actually... in your head that we're necessarily going to go down. This is Mr. Bradley Wiggins. Now, when I compiled this little PowerPoint, I was sort of hoping that I was going to be able to talk about the part he played in a victorious gold medal performance yesterday. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be. But winning the Tour de France isn't too sloppy, is it, really? It has to be said. So good on Mr. Wiggo, Ale Wiggo, as they were saying. And, of course, in recognition of his amazing feet in... his amazing feet and legs and the rest of him, thank you. He got to open the Olympics by ringing the bell. And, of course, that sort of thing doesn't just happen. You don't just wake up one morning, get on your bike and win the Tour de France. You don't just get up one morning and become part of... Team Sky, with all of the amazing effort that goes into that left. Is it? Oh, there we go. This is a quote that I found from a website somewhere, talking about what it takes to be Bradley Wiggins. It is specifically about him. It's a victory for one man's willingness to do everything necessary to be the best. To live against his natural instincts, like a monk for years on end. To set a fearsome training program and follow it to the letter. To sacrifice everything. And apparently his training program is one of the things that particularly has been highlighted as one of the things that probably was responsible for his victory. The training program that he adopted was apparently unlike the sort of training program that cyclists would usually have. It was much more constant throughout the year. It was apparently a bit more like an Olympic swimmer's training program in terms of the schedule and how much of the year it was. It was a relentless, relentless pursuit of excellence to do everything necessary. to sacrifice everything. And then we have this young lady, Jessica Ennis, the poster girl for Team GB. It remains to be seen exactly what she will manage to do, but hopes are very high, and she hasn't been too sloppy so far already. And again, amazing amount of training required to be a heptathlete, which means that, in case you didn't know, this means that over the course of 2 days, she competes in the 100-meter high hurdles, the high jump, the shot put, the 200 meters, the long jump, the javelin throw, and the 800 meters. An amazing combination of skills required, both speed and endurance and power. Absolutely amazing. And when I was at school, secondary school, I was actually, it's probably easy to tell from this amazing physique, but I was actually quite athletic. Athletics was my thing. And we had this thing called the Victor Ludorum. Yes, I went to quite a posh grammar school, I'm afraid. But we had this thing called the Victor Ludorum, which meant you had to get the most number of points over 5 events. And those 5 events could either be 3 track and 2 field or 3 field and 2 track. And the way it kind of worked out with the scheduling of the events and so on, it meant that I had to run the 400 metres and to come in second place in order to win the Victor Ludorum. Trouble was, I really, 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 really don't like running more than about 80 metres. Even then, I was a sprinter. And 400 metres is a killing event. And I remember being told... I actually managed to do it, by the way. Small ripple of applause. I came second. There were 2 people who I knew were faster than me on paper. And I knew, therefore, I had to beat one of them. And apparently, the people who were watching me come down the final straight said that I actually did go green as I was running down the... down this final straight. But I managed it. But that pales into total infinitesimal insignificance compared to what Jessica Ennis has to go through. Here's another quote about her training. Jessica Ennis began her winter schedule at the start of October. She trains 6 to 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, in addition to another 3-hour session once a week. Now, in one sense, I suppose you could look at that and say, well, it is her job, and those are kind of job hours. But the amount of physical effort required, early mornings, self-sacrifice. I was looking around to see if there's anyone here who I know does the early morning commute into London. It's probably very similar, actually, sort of early mornings running, you know, if you're on the train. That's what it takes for Jessica Ennis to be the person that she is, the person who becomes the poster girl for Team GB. This next picture... was actually taken yesterday, and as much as anything, it was just to show off that Lionel were there at Eton Dorney as well. And what a wonderful day it was. I'd echo what Sally says. I do feel somewhat guilty about the fact that we did have tickets in the stand, whereas Chris, who is the ultimate rower, didn't. So I'm going to apologise to him for that next time I see him. But and we bought the tickets on Friday. But this is... I'm not making it any better, am I? But it was an amazing day. This is the eights, as you will be able to count, I should think. And here is what a guy called, it's quite a famous quote, I think. It's a guy called Ashley Tytle, and this is what he said about rowing. Marathon runners talk about hitting the wall at the 23rd mile of the race. What rowers confront isn't a wall, it's a hole, an abyss of pain which opens up in the second minute of the race. Large needles are being driven into your thigh muscles while your forearms seem to be splitting. Then the pain becomes confused and disorganised, not like the windedness of the runner or the leg burn of the biker, but an overall savage unpleasantness. As you pass the 500 metre mark, and this was just past the... this was about 100 metres before the 2 kilometre mark, this photograph. As you pass the 500 metre mark, with 3/4 of the race still to row, you realise with dread that you're not going to make it to the finish. But at the same time, the idea of letting your teammates down by not rowing your hardest is unthinkable. Therefore, you are going to die. Welcome to this life. That is, apparently, the life of a row. Is that about right, sir? Yes, there we go. Amazing what people will give in order for the pursuit of excellence in their chosen, in this case, athletic field of prowess. And we will see the results of that again and again and again, obviously, over the next couple of weeks. I had the privilege of seeing it yesterday in one other race, a world record time set by the New Zealand pair, who ended up a ridiculous amount of stuff. I mean, it was a heat, for goodness sake. It was a first heat. Everyone afterwards was saying, what on earth are they doing putting in this time in a heat? They won by about 9 lengths. I have got a photograph where you can't see any other boat in the picture. Seriously. I thought about putting that one up, but it didn't. At first glance, it doesn't look like much of a race, so I thought this one was better graphically. But there is no one. It's the same view, but they're in the middle, and there's no one else. What training did they have to do that meant that actually they probably couldn't go any slower? That's how fast they go. Because of the training that they've done. And then there's this guy. Now, I don't think that's not actually a picture of the Apostle Paul, but it's a picture I found on Google that's supposed to be him, and it looks like it's old, so maybe you know, he looked a bit like that, you never know. And as some of you will know, the Apostle Paul, writing the New Testament, actually used the illustration of training and being an athlete, looking at the sorts of athletic games that they had in his day in the first century. He used this analogy several times, actually. Here's one of them. It's from the Message translation of the Bible. You've all been to the stadium and seen the athletes race. Everyone runs, one wins. Run to win. I don't know about you, but I'm running hard for the finish line. I'm giving it everything I've got. No sloppy living for me. I'm staying alert and in top condition. Paul here is comparing the life and the training of an athlete with his dedication to living for Jesus. It's quite a challenge, isn't it? Particularly when we just have the concrete examples of what that really means for an athlete to train. The dedication, the self-sacrifice. And Paul here says that just as he knows athletes do that, so he is going to live for Jesus in that way. I'm told by people who run a lot that when you get to a certain stage of running, actually, it becomes enjoyable. That after a while, you know, actually, you've kind of got through that point where every time you go out, it's just awful, which is, I've never got beyond that stage. And it's actually, there is a kind of an exhilaration, and you can actually enjoy running along and through the countryside and so on. I find that unfathomable, if I'm really honest. But actually, this morning as I walked into the prayer meeting, John Sandeman was praying, not knowing I was going to use this illustration at all, was praying about just this verse, really, and about the fact that actually, as we sort of pursue Jesus, that it's not just effort we're talking about. There is also a sense in which we go into greater degrees of joy. A bit like runners actually reaching that point of it actually being enjoyable. So Paul isn't just talking about grind, but nevertheless, there is a challenge here for those of us following Jesus, just to do a little bit of a mental checklist about what we're actually giving to this. But of course, the point is, it's not from any kind of legalism. It has to come from the heart. People like Jessica Ennis couldn't do what they're doing, I am sure, unless we say, don't we, their heart is really in it. If your heart isn't in it, you couldn't do it. There was a great rower yesterday I saw just at the other end of the spectrum from the New Zealand guys. It was a single sculler. And Lina and I actually saw him as we walked down towards the start line. So we saw him after about, well, less than 500 metres, 200 metres from the start line, I should think. And bless him, he was already about 9 lengths behind everybody else. He was from one of the poorer nations of the world, and I don't know how often he actually got to row, but his heart was in it. I actually would have loved to have been at the end, at the stand, when he crossed the line, because when there were people like that, the stand really erupted for them in respect for their heart being in it. Paul's heart was in, oh, it's raining. Paul's heart was in living for Jesus. So that's kind of the athletic bit. Just for a few minutes, I just want to think about a different aspect. And I'm going to ask this, but it's quiz time, people, okay? It's quiz time. It's a little job for you to do. In the UK, what are the most popular types of charities in terms of what people actually give to? And if you are a professional and you know the answer, then you can just shush just for a moment. But in terms of the percentage of all of the people who give to charity in the UK, what percentage give to, you know, just think of some categories of different sorts of charitable cause. Just spend about, I'm going to give you 2 minutes, talk to the person next to you, consult. What do you think? What do you think the top three are? Okay, what do we think? What gold, silver, bronze position? What do we think is the cause that, of the people who give anything to charity, what percentage, you know, what's the highest percentage in terms of what people give to? Sally? Animals? Actually not. Children? Actually not. Well, let's be a little more general. It is indeed medical research. Medical research gets 17% of all charitable giving, and that is 38% of anyone who gives anything, 38% of them give it to medical research. Okay, so that's the gold medal position. This was a 2011 report looking back on the previous 12 months. What's the silver position? Animals, children? Actually, it is religious. And sorry, that's not sure if both of those should be 16%, but certainly it was 16% of charitable giving. It was from smaller, that's a misprint there, mistyped by me. But it's a smaller percentage than 16%. But it's 16% of all charitable giving went to religious causes. The bronze medal position is children. 11% of all charitable giving, 24% of all donors. And then in joint fourth place, you know that place they always say in all the athletes, the worst place to be, you know, you haven't quite got a medal. Hospitals and overseas, both those 10% with that percentage of donors. This was from the UK Giving 2011 report done by those two institutions. So how much do you think we give? First of all, what is the mean average? By which I don't mean the stingy mean. I mean the normal thing we mean by average, why you add everything up and divide by the number of people. So what is the mean average amongst people who give to anything? What do you think the amount of money per annum is? Any guesses? £10 here? £30 there? £100 there? Well, the lollipop goes to Mary because it is £31. Wow. Is the mean average. But of course, that is if you add everything up. So that's taking into account the people giving millions. So actually, it's quite often expressed more in terms of this thing called the median. That's where you put all the amounts in a row and look for the one in the middle. do you think that was then? That was £11. That means, just to kind of translate that for the people who like me are statistically challenged, it means that 50% of people who give at all give £11 or less. A year. A year. What percent should people give more than £100? Well, that is about 8% of the people who give at all. And here we go. Do I really want to do this one? Who are more inclined to give, men or women? Hands up for women. Hands up for men. And the answer is women. Especially those aged 45 to 64. By the way, in terms of the amount, if you just look at religious causes, then the median amount is £15. So 50% of people giving to religious causes of any type give £15 or less per annum. Some interesting numbers. Really, it comes down to this. Matthew 6 and verse 21 says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Now, I often, when I'm talking about this verse, point out the order that that is in, which is that actually the what Jesus said was that when you give, your heart follows that. But often it's read the other way around, and I guess you can interpret it either way around. The point being that there is a strong connection between where our heart is and our giving. That's true of all of those athletes. There's a strong connection between where their heart is, their rather supercharged, beating slowly at rest part, where their heart is and what they're giving to, what they're giving their life to. There's a strong connection between what people want to give their finances to and where their heart is. I suspect that those people giving to medical charities, if you looked at their family story, there would in many, 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 if not all cases, be a story there about giving to medical research to do with something that has happened to them, to their parents, to their children, to their relatives, to their close friends. There's a heart connection. There appears to be quite a strong heart connection to animals. It does figure on the list. And fortunately, in this context, there does seem to be a strong connection to people giving to, we wouldn't want to use the word religious causes in that sense, but faith causes, which is good. And the median amount is above the average for all giving. As Paul said, what we, you know, in his sort of comparison with athletes, if we're going to live for this, let's really live for it. Let's put our heart into it. And our money and our resources. Why? Well, it kind of comes full circle to what Keith said to us right at the beginning of the meeting, when he said something like, as I wrote it down, the amazing lengths that people will go to for love. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. Tom, I wonder if you could come back. I'd like to do Grace Like Rain again, actually, if that's okay. The band. And this is the reality, isn't it? This is why Paul felt as he did about living for Jesus, because he had grasped absolutely what Jesus had given for him, what God had given for him. Not out of compulsion, because no one was going to coerce God to do anything, but out of love. And we are the recipients of love from a God who has said, my heart is for these people. And in order that they can be with me, have lives lived to the very fullest in this life and on into the next, I'm going to give my very best. God so loved the world that he gave. So for those of us that know and love Jesus, let's just reflect a little bit on those words of Paul. And as we look at all of the activity over the next couple of weeks and are amazed by what people can actually do when they've put their heart into it, let's both be challenged and encouraged about what can happen if we put our heart into living for Jesus. Perhaps let's be challenged about our resources and our finances, but so much more than that. And whoever we are, just as we close, and I'd like to sing this song again that talks about the amazing grace of God, let's just be wowed by God's heart towards us. We talked a lot about the wow factor on Friday night. Well, there were a lot of wow factors in that opening ceremony, but nothing that even approaches the wow factor of really grasping that God so loved each and every one of us that he gave. Father, I want to thank you for your love this morning. And thank you that I'm a recipient of that. And thank you that Jesus ran that race for the joy set before him. And that joy, I was part of that joy. And each one of us here are part of that joy as Jesus ran his race. Lord, I just want to say with my friends that I want to run that race for you.